Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry Podcast. This is episode number 456. And today we have the story of a hunting adventure unlike anything we've ever talked about. And it is a pretty unique and wild experience. And although it's probably something you will never do or that I will never do, it is both an entertaining story, but also cool just to hear about some different requirements in terms of logistics and gear that maybe could be helpful for some of your future hunts in at least some aspects. So the story is a spring bison hunt in Alaska that took place with hundreds of miles of snowmobiling. So again, I don't know if that's new to you, but it's definitely new to me. My friend and guide, Mark Roenhorst from Alaska, who you maybe heard on the podcast before or heard as part of like my sheep or goat hunting experiences, he was joined by his cousin Chris and their buddy Hunter, and the three of them went on this hunt that you will hear about today. It's a great story. I'm excited to share it with you. Before we dive into that, as always, guys, just want to remind you, it does help us tremendously if you're able to leave any sort of rating or review in the podcast app that you use. Or if you're sharing the show, just tell a friend about it. Maybe send them a link to it. That would also help us tremendously. Again, we don't do any advertising, any paid promotion, don't have any sponsors, don't do anything like that. So it's just your support of the show that helps us continue doing it and also helps it grow. So thank you for taking the time to do that. And finally, if you do have any questions or anything like that for us directly, be sure to send those via email to podcast@xomountaingear.com. But right now, let's dive into this episode. Well, guys, welcome to the show. I'm excited to chat today. Mark, you've obviously been on the podcast before. We've had you on, I think, before my goat hunt, kind of talked about your background and introduction and how you became a guide in Alaska and all that good stuff. So that's there. We can leave a link to that. And I'm just going to essentially skip most of your introduction. But I want you, Mark, to begin with to introduce Chris instead of Chris introducing himself at first.
Right on. Sounds good. Yeah, I'm glad to be back on. Fun story to tell. Chris is my cousin. We, for a little while, they lived by us in Iowa. But by the time, I think at five or six, Chris's family moved out to Washington. But yeah, Chris has been a good cousin, good friend. And since I moved to Alaska, he's kind of become one of my main hunting partners and comes up to help with a few hunts basically every year since 2017, I think. We did a personal hunt together for caribou and sheep. And ever since then, he's been helping on hunts that I guide. And now he's got his assistant guide license.
Chris, you had been pretty excited when this whole thing came together of like, hey, my cousin and good friend Mark's going to Alaska and going to create some opportunity and some level of convenience, I guess, to go up there and hunt more. That had been exciting.
Yeah, I didn't really, I mean, I was into hunting back then, but I wasn't really big into it. So I wasn't so knowledgeable about it. But then when I saw what he was doing, I was like, I got to get up there. So then, yeah, we did that hunt in 2017 and I got addicted, man. And I've been trying to go back every year at least once or twice.
Well, I don't know anything about this hunt that you guys went on. I don't know the backstory, how it came together. I just know that you guys were doing it. It's a wild adventure. It's something unique. And I selfishly just wanted to hear about it and thought we might as well hit record and kind of share the story. I guess to begin with, Chris, when did this hunt land on your radar? And then I guess talk about, you know, applying, finding out. And then I think these types of hunts is, you can look at them and research them, but it's not till you get really serious about it that you realize just what a big like adventure and logistical challenge it can be. But I guess go back to the beginning. When did it hit your radar? When did you apply? What happened when you found out you draw?
Well, yeah, it kind of all came about almost by accident. We were in goat camp in Southeast Alaska, or you've been there, and the paper regs came out. It was a year and a half ago now, and there was a misprint in the paper regs for a new sheep unit that opened up, and it said non-guided, non-resident could apply. So Mark's like, dude, you got to apply for this. So I bought my license that following month. I tried applying online. It wouldn't let me, wouldn't let me. So I called Fish and Game and they said, oh, it was a misprint. It's next of kin, non-guided. So I was like, oh man. Well, then Mark's like, hey, since you bought your license, apply for muskox and bison. And he gave me the two units to apply for. And I honestly had never even thought about doing this or anything. And then, yeah, a couple weeks later, he called me. I was at work. He's like, he must have known because he's like, go check the results. And he was like, I looked and I was like, no way, I drew it. So, yeah, then it all started from there. And we really had no idea what we were in for. And there's not a ton of information out there on this hunt either, like if you try and research it. But that's one thing Mark is really, really good at. Is and he knows a lot of people up there. I mean, everybody in Alaska knows everybody. So that helped a ton. And yeah, luckily we had a year to plan it and we kind of just dove in after that.
What was your level of context, Mark, in terms of these hunts that are out there? I think 1 year I applied for it and somewhat knew that it was logistically very difficult. And then hearing what I do know about your guys' experience and doing some other research after I'd applied, thought I would be hosed if I drew this hunt. Like, there's no way I could pull this off. But like, yeah, I guess like what did you know about him, Mark, beforehand?
Yeah, for this specific hunt, I didn't know a lot. I mean, I had some idea what logistics would be like, but when you look at the available bison permit hunts in Alaska, there's primarily three. They've in three different areas, and one of them is a Delta Junction area, and that's generally, I mean, that's easy access, relatively easy access, and a lot of times, a lot of the harvest there is actually on private property. That one didn't really appeal to me. And then the Copper River area is another one where it can be a little higher adventure, tough logistics. But they recently had the Native Corporation in that area had recently closed it. Close hunting on their land, and a vast majority of the hunting of that herd occurs on that Native Corp land. So then there's this other permit, the Farewell McGrath area permit, and I knew that it's remote. I mean, you can't drive out there by any means. It's either a fly out or on this winter tag, it's a snow machine, snowmobile expedition. So I didn't know exactly what that was going to look like going into it, but in talking with some friends, people who've done it, it turned out that the most advice I got was the best way to do it would be to use snow machines to get in there and then have air support. So that's basically what we planned on doing. But as far as access, there are probably multiple ways to go in, but the primary way is to use the Iditarod Trail from the Willow area north of Anchorage to get out there. There's a fall hunt too, and the fall hunt obviously would look considerably different than this winter permit. The winter one's just for March, but then that fall one, I think that's basically you have to fly out there, and most of those guys do a float hunt or something to that extent.
Do you have any idea what the like a rough odds are for the, and I'm sure it probably varies based on, you kind of mentioned those different hunt opportunities, but I mean, these are pretty low odds of like drawing this tag as a non-resident. I mean, even for a resident, it's draw, but I mean, do you have any rough idea like what those odds or numbers look like?
I mean, I think I have to look it up to be sure, but they for this March permit, it's they give out 5 permits, and I don't, do you remember? It was like 1,400 or 1,500 people put in for it, give or take. Do you remember, Chris?
Yeah, which seems pretty low to me, but I think the draw odds were a little less than 1% or something.
Yeah, I would assume too, if people do enough research to realize how challenging this hunt is, that that's going to keep people from applying if they know better, you know, if they know, like, can I actually pull this thing off?
Yeah, who knows what people like. I'd had no idea. And if Mark hadn't have talked me into it, I would have never applied for it. And if I didn't have Mark for all this logistical stuff, I would have been in this, like, I would have been upriver, right? Not know what to do.
It's one that if you throw in for it without knowing, you'd either be eating it or you'd be looking at hiring an outfitter for sure. For a non-resident, it's like you really have to have an Alaska resident help with a lot of equipment and stuff. So yeah, there's sure a lot that goes into it.
When you said earlier going in on snow machines but having air support, by air support you mean getting bison out if you're successful, or even I guess it'd be a backup extraction method too. You guys have an issue or a problem with the snow machine, can't get out, like essentially have air support on standby for whether it's meat or, you know, SOS type thing.
Yeah, that was most of the advice I got, was that it's probably not ideal to try to haul all your camp plus a bison back over the pass and, 200 to 300 miles out. So the best thing was to have it flown out if you're successful. And then for our use, we had our pilot stock fuel for us in there, so that we didn't have to haul too much fuel with us, just again saving weight. And then if something did go wrong, machine wise or something, breakdowns, you might need spare parts or something flown in.
You say 200 to 300 miles in.
Yeah, so
Yep.
we didn't know exactly what it was, just going off kind of like Iditarod checkpoints, how far it was from the takeoff point to the hunt area. And it's kind of on the like minimum side. You're scratching the surface of the hunt area at 200 miles, give or take. And then, wherever the hunt leads you from there. So we kind of figured we were going to be in for 250 miles. I kind of thought was a minimum one way.
Crazy. This is skipping ahead like some pre-hunt stuff, but what did that end up looking like on the hunt, distance-wise?
Total, when we got back to the truck, our sleds read 500 miles.
Yeah, I think I had work 499.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
Wild.
we estimated around 600 to be safe. And yeah, I mean, we could have easily done that. We'll get into that. But yeah, 500 was probably about the bare minimum, I'd say.
So what I know I chatted with you super briefly, Mark, as you I think maybe a few weeks before this hunt, and was trying to get an idea, and you were talking with some guys who had run machines in this area and like how much ground you could cover and how quick that could go. What did that end up looking like for you guys? Like you're going 200 miles in, call it 250 miles in. What type of time commitment is that? To actually go from the truck to the hunt area, time-wise.
Yeah, it was kind of hard to know for sure. I had a friend that did it just a few years ago, that he said they made it all the way to the hunt area in one big day. I also have another friend that runs the Iron Dog race, which is a snow machine snowmobile. race along the Iditarod. It's basically the same trail. There's a couple detours, but I mean, those guys absolutely fly. He's like, "Oh, you can make it there, no problem, in a day." And I was like, "You're doing it completely different, totally different machines. Those guys absolutely fly, and obviously not hauling freight like we were gonna be with trailer sleds and all that sort of stuff." So it was really hard to say. So the way we planned it, we're gonna attempt to make it in a day, if at all possible. But we were definitely prepared to camp along the way as needed. So we really didn't know. But I mean, Chris can go into if you're, I don't know if you want us to say how it actually went.
I'd love to just kind of hear again. I know we can maybe backtrack to some pre-hunt stuff, but how did that go, Chris? The logistics of kicking this hunt off and doing that travel.
So we had given ourselves a day ahead of season. So we drove down. It's about a 6 hour drive. And then we actually got a little Airbnb for the night in Willow, stayed in Willow. Then we figured we'd just take off in the morning. We'd make it to Roan, no problem, which is 180, 190 miles in. And yeah, I mean, we were humbled pretty quick when we hit that trail, towing sleds and the difference. And yeah, it was pretty rough the first, I'd say, 30 miles, 40 miles, just strapping stuff down on the sleds and figuring it all out. And yeah, we struggled quite a bit with stuff bouncing around. We actually lost a snowshoe that caused us a lot of time lost because we went back and looked for it and ended up never finding it. So then yeah, we got into Squintna, which is about 67 miles in, and we thought we'd eat there. And it was about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And yeah, so we sat there and we kind of ordered food, and then we got to thinking and talking, and we're like, man, it's just. And we had had reports from Mark's buddy the day before he tried going over, and the wind was so bad, it wind blowing the whole trail, and you couldn't even find the trail in spots. And so we decided just to stay there for the night because we knew the Iditarod trail crew was ahead of us a little ways too, which helped. And they were breaking trail. So that kind of, in the end, changed our mind to stay the night and just wait it out, which I was kind of reluctant to at first because, I mean, I had the tag and I just wanted to get in there, but I think by far it was the best decision.
Yeah, part of that too was, well, like Chris said, the trail crew breaking trail, so we wanted to let them get ahead of us a ways. But also we knew by the sounds of it, we probably weren't gonna make it, at the rate we were going. And so then if the rates at the Squintna Roadhouse were reasonable just to stay there, it would save us setting up and breaking down camp, which would be several hours, of work, a big winter camp like that between setup and breakdown in the morning. So we thought if we could stay at that roadhouse, that would save us quite a bit of time in the end.
I'm completely ignorant to, like, when you guys say trail and snow machines for something remote like this, yet established because it's part of the Iditarod. Like, what does the trail look like? But yeah, describe it. I don't even know. I'm assuming it's just, kind of more cut and packed snow. But when you talk about it getting blown over and then trail maintenance, like, what is that crew doing to quote unquote clear the trail? I don't even know.
Well, so the first actual 70 to 80 miles from that, we started in Deshka Landing, which is a big parking lot. You pay to park, and in the summertime, it's a big river boat launch. So it's a really big established area. And then the first 70 to 80 miles is like basically running up the river, and there's freight haulers running into all these places because the best time to haul gear and fuel and lumber and everything is in the wintertime with snowmobiles or snowcats. So the first 80 miles, I mean, it's like a freeway. It's probably 100 yards wide on this river. And then you have snow-capped trails all over the place. And there's a couple different routes you can end up taking, but it's all very well marked. There's actually mile post markers up to Squintna. So yeah, we were in for a shock too when we hit that big trail. And we're like, holy smokes, we can fly. Because we were average probably 30 to 40 miles an hour on that trail. But yeah, then after that, it definitely necks down to a single snowmobile width trail through the trees. And after the Iron Dog race, it's just all tore up and big whoops. And so the trail crew, they run through. There's about six or seven guys on snowmobiles, and they have chainsaws and markers they're putting down with reflectors on them, marking the trail, cutting trees out. And then the back two guys actually have giant metal groomers they're dragging just the width of a snowmobile, and they're just kind of leveling the snow behind the snowmobiles.
Yeah, so if there's any like steep parts or something like that, they'll shovel it out to flatten things out. But yeah, more or less just what they are, the trail crews breaking trail.
So going back to logistics, this idea of taking extra time getting in there, spending the night, et cetera. Chris, what type of time did you have available? Because, non-resident work, family, et cetera, but this is obviously a big expedition of a hunt. What type of time frame did you have, or was it pretty open-ended?
Pretty open-ended. I mean, like, this is a once in a lifetime tag, so I knew I could never draw it again. So we had to commit to it. And at the same time, I knew we thought we could easily do it. So we gave ourselves about 11 days in there. And so I took 3 weeks off work, and I went up there for probably 4 days ahead of time, 5 days. Just because the packing and logistics and getting everything ready was so big too, I wanted to be able to help Mark out. So we were up there, and then we gave ourselves a day ahead of season. And then we had to be out, I think, the 11th at the latest, because we actually took one of our, another guy, Hunter from Montana. He helps out too with Mark up there, and he volunteered to come up because he needs more days in the field for his license. So he had to be home, I think flew out on the 12th. And then Mark's kids were actually on spring break. So just everything kind of worked out. We had about 10 days to hunt in there, and we figured we had plenty of time.
Are the success rates pretty good on these hunts?
Yeah, on snowmobiles, yes. And if you commit and actually go in there, I think it's pretty high.
Man, they're like, I'm sure we could spend an hour plus just talking about the fine nitty-gritty details of like logistics and gear and what's required and backup stuff and contingencies you don't think of compared to a normal backpack hunt, right? Like, I'm always amazed just even car camping versus backpacking. Every time I'm like, man, this is so much more complex. So, like, car camp than backpack, right? Like, there's just more opportunities, more stuff. And of course, a hunt like this, like remote winter in Alaska, machines, winter camp, extra clothes. Like, I can't even begin to imagine how much went into it. But what were some of the big things for you, Mark, that logistically you tried to figure out, like what is going to work? What does camp look like? What are the some of the things we don't normally think about that we have to think about, or maybe things you learned along the process of researching, just from the logistics or gear, any of that pre-planning stuff?
Yeah, even living up here, I haven't done a whole lot of that type of stuff, the winter camping. So I knew that we were going to have, a hot tent capability if we did see the lower end of the temperature spectrum. Same with snowmobiles, not a ton of experience with them. And so everything that goes along with runs snowmobiles and trailers behind them, all the equipment that goes with that, and what you should have for potential repairs and service in the field. That was an incredible difference and learning curve. And then same with all the winter base camp style stuff. Like you said, it's just incredibly different than the simplicity of a backpacking setup. I learned so much in that year talking to other people trying to plan for it in regards to like what machines would be ideal for a trip like this, what type of sleds to use, what we're going to need for size of sleds and machines, and then camp. There's a wide variety. We could attempt to cold camp it, but otherwise we had wall tent options, or we could go on the light side, like a sil nylon teepee, lightweight style camp. Or the most popular thing up here is an Arctic oven tent, which are they have some proprietary fabric that's highly breathable but also insulative for severe cold. And so if at all possible, I was going to try to get my hands on one of those. And then what type of stove to bring with that, whether you're going to go with like a fuel run stove. There's some options that run off like diesel kerosene or propane, or just stick with the wood stove. Just a wide variety of options, but major learning curve. And without, having a network of people to pick the brains of, it would have been quite a bit tougher too. And I mean, we borrowed slash rented a ton of gear, as well as bought a ton of new gear. And Chris can attest to that. Even going quote non-guided, it was a very, very expensive trip.
What did you end up doing for shelter, stove, and fuel?
So we I was I had considered buying an Arctic oven. I thought it would be a good option for the family and other base camp scenarios. But I had a hard time deciding on model and wasn't sure, how much use I'd put into it for, you can easily get into the $3,000-$4,000 price range with those, between tent and stove and everything, all the accessories. So I ended up being able to borrow one from a guy that we ended up renting another machine from. So that worked out really well, I would say. So we borrowed an Arctic oven. The AO10 is what it is. So it's a 10 by 10 tent. And then we decided to go with just a buddy heater running off propane. A little buddy heater. So that's what we did for stove setup. And then we also took a lightweight, packable titanium wood stove, kind of for backup, and knowing that propane heat can kick off a lot of moisture. We'd have that wood option to dry stuff out if it was getting gnarly. But the buddy heater is just so simple and easy to keep going rather than feeding wood stove and cutting firewood all the time.
If they work.
If they work.
Chris, for you, obviously Mark's up there in Alaska. He's doing a good amount of research, some of the call it the heavy lifting on logistics in terms of snow machines, these big items like shelter, etc. What were some of the things you had to consider? Obviously, I think of like personally, like your system, clothing, gear, et cetera, that you had to take care of for yourself. What were some of those items or things you learned?
Well, yeah, like you said, we could spend hours talking about gear and stuff. We spent a year researching it, and we're kind of still going into it blind. It's just a totally different hunt. Normally, you just grab your backpack, you know what you need for camp, this, that, and but yeah, we needed stuff to be prepared. They say it can be negative 40 degrees up to 30 degrees. You just never know that time of year. So we had to be prepared for negative 40 degree temperatures. And I mean, yeah, that first night in, I think on the other side of the pass, it reached negative 33. So we were kind of overwhelmed, but yeah, we just did a lot of research. And yeah, like Mark said, we bought a lot of new gear. And then I kind of just did a lot of research on the snowmobiles and what is the major things that break, and making sure we had the right tools, extra parts like fuel filters, plugs, belts, all that kind of stuff. And then I contacted a guy that we knew had a plane and an actual camp set up back in there, and made sure we had air support, extra fuel if we needed it, and a backup camp just in case. So we kind of just tried to cover all our bases.
Yeah, as
Yeah.
far as Chris was part of it, even though I'm the one like physically here, boots on the ground, there was still a lot I left on Chris's plate to do, a lot of the planning and logistics. Chris is like incredibly more mechanically inclined than I am. So his skills really offset my weak point. So he was like putting together our toolkit and any spare parts that we'd need, which was super, super helpful.
I don't know anything actually like regulatory or otherwise about these hunts and what's legal for harvest and things like that. So in terms of you, the hunter, the tag holder, anything from the legal requirements to like quote unquote judging an animal, deciding what you want to shoot, like talk to me about that whole aspect of actually hunting bison up there.
Yeah, so I mean, we were kind of in the dark too when we got into this, and Alaska is really good about it. They actually sent me a big packet almost a year in advance of judging the bison, and because this is the winter hunt is a bull only, so it has to be a bull that you kill, and it can be kind of tough judging a non-mature bison. Just by looking at their face and horns, and obviously looking for the male anatomy and stuff like that. But so we were kind of not sure how difficult it was going to be. So we did, I mean, they send you the coolest little packet with everything in there and little test quizzes and stuff like that. And I was pretty confident though we'd be able to tell. And I mean, I'm not the type of guy that goes out and passes animals a lot either. So I knew it was going to be a little different. So I was like, I had a mindset going in. I'm like, we're gonna find a big bull, we're gonna pass up a bunch of bulls, and we're just gonna see all these bison, and I'm gonna be picky and choosy, right? But yeah, we got that was a little different story when we got in there too.
Wow. Are they generally kind of herded up at this time of year? Like it's kind of like if you find a bison, you're finding a dozen or two dozen, or can like are bulls separated off and more solo or small numbers? I have no idea.
So what I learned from just talking to people and our pilot, he said that normally they're all spread out everywhere, kind of just in their own little groups. You'll see cow-calf pairs, and normally the bulls are kind of up by themselves somewhere or in a little bachelor group running around, but they're very spread out this time of year. So that's kind of what we were assuming going into it, but yeah, it was a little bit different when we got in there too.
Well, let's talk about getting in there. Let's not that I don't have other questions, but just to like pick up on the story. So you guys did this overnight, I guess. I mean, again, like I have zero context for what happens, how this thing goes, if it takes, you know, a day, or if it's like it goes when I hunt with Mark and it takes 10 days every time, which is probably my bad luck. So yeah, like you guys leave, it sounds like this roadhouse the next day, take that where it goes.
Well, yeah, and like you said, your bad luck, but I'm starting to wonder if it's Mark's bad luck, because every time I hunt with them too, we ha everything that could possibly go wrong seems to go wrong. And yeah, that first day we got pretty humbled on the trail. I mean, it's logistically just so much work, and hauling big trailers with tons of gear on the snowmobiles. So we got to that Squintner Roadhouse, and it was probably 3 o'clock, and we ate the that Squintner Roadhouse is awesome. Cindy runs that place, and awesome food. So we had food, and we got kind of bored, so we asked her if there was anything we could do, and she's like, "Well, you guys could go shovel some snow off the roofs." So we went and shoveled snow for a couple hours off a couple roofs because they had a pretty big snow load on some of the roofs, and yeah, we just kind of enjoyed our time there and spent the night, and we made her get up early. We had breakfast at 7. She cooked us breakfast, and then we hit the trail again. And then, yeah, I'd say within 10 to 15 miles of the trail, we hit the actual like trail where it's single lane, you're going through trees, and I mean, it is bumpy. And with these big giant sleds behind the snowmobiles, it just like teeter totters over the humps. So when the sled's going up, your snowmobile's going down, and it is just violently thrashing the snowmobile. And it was pretty rough. And I mean, it's hard on everything in that sled. And the sled Hunter was actually towing was a skinnier sled style sled with an actual metal tube hitching. And we started having problems with that thing just wanting to roll over. And he was struggling all day with that thing rolling over. So we fought that a little bit. We got up to Finger Lake, and the actual Iditarod checkpoint is there, one of them. And the guys that were running the Roan checkpoint, there was three guys on snowmobiles, and they were heading over. And they said the trail crew had left a couple hours before. They're like, "Yeah, we're just going to follow them in there." So we jumped on the trail, kind of piggybacking with those guys. And one of them actually broke an A-arm pretty fast into it. So we stopped and helped them. Messed around with that a little bit, and then we caught the trail crew before we even hit the pass because the trail had been pretty rough, wind blown, trees down, and we caught the trail crew. We kind of messed around with them for a little bit, piggybacking back and forth, and then they told us they were just going to stop at Rainy Pass, which is not too far from Roan, but we wanted to just make it down to Roan to be safe, and we didn't really have an option up there, and lodging up there is quite a bit more expensive. So we actually passed them around a little ways after Finger Lake. No, quite a ways after that. But we passed them and ended up going over the pass, and it was howling wind, and all of the snow and ice was just making these gnarly little bumps and wind drifts. And that little sled really struggled going over that pass, just rolling over. And then, yeah, we dropped down into the Dalzell coming down the pass. And then you jump into the Tatina River. But then coming down that Dalzell, that trailer ended up tipping over. And it must have hit something solid because we had a 30-gallon fuel drum in there and then a big action packer up front. And we were working on it. Oh, the hitch broke. That's what happened. The front of the hitch broke. Right, Mark?
On like as we're going down the Tatina,
Well, that was, yeah, like
before
right
that.
coming down the Dalzell when Hunter's hitch broke off and then it rolled over. It must have hit something solid
Oh, that's
because
right.
we stopped to work on it and I smelled fuel. I was like, "I smell fuel." And we started looking around and yeah, that 30-gallon fuel jug had a big split kind of up towards the top of it and it was dumping fuel out. So we quick scrambled, unhooked it, and then kind of tipped it up to where that crack was up top. And then we had brought a big siphon hose and water separator funnels and a bunch of stuff. So we quick started siphoning fuel into the snowmobiles to try and lower the level of that tank. And we got it quite a bit. Almost empty. I'd say there's probably 10 gallons left in it, 10, 15 gallons. So that was a pretty big time crunch. And then, yeah, just pet. And then the people on the trail, because they actually are running the ITI at the same time, which is the race on foot. They can do 350 miles to McGrath or the whole 1,000 miles to Nome. And it's either snowshoe, foot, ski or fat tire bike, which was pretty interesting. So we were kind of passing people going up and over the pass and coming down the Dalzell and the Tatina too. So we got into Roan pretty late that night and it was cold. We were cold. Everything was beat up. So we actually tried to get into the cabin, but the cabin was full of these ITI people for their checkpoint. So we knew this guy had a little winter camp slash like carport style cabins up there. So we kind of went in there and just kind of warmed up for a bit. He had a little diesel stove in there. We got the diesel heater going. And then we were thinking of just unpacking our stuff and that actual front action packer on the sled that got broken and full of snow. We started digging into that. Our buddy heater was in there, packed with snow, and there was a lantern in there. The lantern had shattered, so there's glass shards all over inside everything. So we struggled to get that buddy heater working. We could not get it going, and we were kind of in a bad spot. So we're like, we got to stay here for the night. So we ended up posting up at that little place. And I mean, that thing saved our butt. It was cold and we warmed up pretty fast. So we kind of just worked on that buddy heater that night too, because we were getting kind of nervous because that was our main source of heat. And it ended up being a loose fitting at the very bottom of it. Mark has a couple of videos of me trying to light it and it would just light up and then just a big boof, the propane would kick in. So I tore it apart and I actually found the fitting. So we got that tightened up, dried out. So then the next morning we had it running really good. So we felt safe again and comfortable again taking it the rest of the journey. So yeah, that second day was quite an adventure too. And so that was the first day of season. That was March 1st. So that was opening day.
Yeah, that made me think a little bit about the planning of our timing. The tag is for all of March, but we knew with these races going on, it was we could kind of wait till everything was done, wait till after I did a rod, and then go in and not have and probably have way less people on the trails and stuff like that. In the end, we decided to go in between. So they run Iron Dog, the snow machine race. Like around February 20 to 25, something like that. And then they run this foot race. I think they started on the 27th or 28th or something like that. So we knew we were going to be passing those guys on our way in. And our I guess our idea was that we'd be in between all these races so that the trail should be broke. But we didn't want to get behind or get mixed up with the Iditarod racers because we knew like on the trail that will be more difficult to like bypass people and we didn't, you know, Iditarod's kind of a big deal and has a long history and we didn't want to be getting in the way of dog teams and stuff like that. So we decided, you know, a few days before Iditarod was going to start, we'd have plenty of time to get all the way in there. Hopefully the trail was broke. And then while we're out there, you know, we yield to the dog sled teams as needed. And it would be a cool experience, you know, to witness Iditarod while we're out there. And then they'd all go through and the trail would be clear going back. So that was part of that too. It was fascinating, real quick on that ride, just passing those ITIers on foot and ski and bike. Just man, what those people do. You know,
That's
we kind
wild.
of start thinking that we're tough for a lot of the hunts that we've done. But man, those guys, it was like, you know, 20 below and 30 to 40 mile an hour winds going up through the pass and you see these guys, you know, pulling their pulk sleds and just roughing it. And man, they had such minimal gear. I was shocked. Like they camp so minimally, more so than we do backpacking. I mean, they're generally just bivvies, 40 below bags. And the ones that we talked to, the intel we got, they're only using like a Therm-a-Rest Z rest pad.
Holy cow.
No ab air pass or anything like that, just laying up, bivvying out, just straight cold camping in, you know, potentially 50 below weather they can get. And
That's
I just
crazy.
can't imagine doing that. I don't know what that looks like as far as camp life and keeping water available and lighting stoves and melting snow for water and food. Man, I was shocked.
Yeah, we thought we were pretty tough, and we're passing these people on the trail going in, and we got pretty humbled.
Did you guys get to a point where you were truly like, okay, let's get to this hunt area? Or I guess in terms of logistics of this hunt progressing, are you trying to locate bison and then set camp? Are you trying to set camp and then hunt out of it and cover ground? Like, what was the plan going into it, and then how did that actually happen?
Yeah, I mean, the plan going in, we knew we had shelter in Roan if need be. And then there was actually a couple little cabins here and there spread out. And there's another cabin in Bear Creek, which is so in between Roan and Bear Creek is kind of the bison area too. So we knew we had those two options if need be. But then, yeah, our plan was kind of get in there, find them, and then kind of set up close to it. Because it's such a big area. We didn't know exactly how we were going to go about it. So we kind of were just playing it by ear.
Yeah, so that next day after we camped at the guides, pilots camp, we were trying to decide if we're going to haul camp with us that next day and just find a place to set up our camp, or ultimately we decided on just doing like kind of a scouting mission, I guess, more or less, try to find bison, try to figure out what the rest of that next stretch of trail looks like. And I think our plan leaving that day was try to get to the Bear Creek cabin, because if it was open, we thought we wanted to take advantage of one of those public use cabins if we could, rather than tent camping. So our plan was to try to get there and scout along the way. And as it worked out, I mean, we were just kind of constantly behind schedule that next stretch of trail. Even though they had a ton of snow on the south side of the mountains, on that north side, which I knew from the Iron Doggers, that there was a stretch of dry trail of like, I don't know, 20 to, I mean, the stretch that we did, I guess, was 20 miles, basically dry trail, like no snow on it. So it's extremely rough on the machines, slow going, and the trail itself was rough. It's all moguled from the Iron Dog race. And so we dinked around far more than we thought. We went down to check out the river to see if the river was better travel, if it was frozen up good. But we knew Iron Dog had dealt with a whole lot of open water on that river too. So we checked out the river. For the most part, it was fine, but we were, it's just kind of sketchy going on a frozen river where nobody else has been on, and potential open water weak spots. So we got sketched out of that, went back to the trail and took the trail, and it didn't take long to realize we were not going to make it to that next public use cabin, which I think was from Roan, was 50 miles or so, I think we estimated. So we checked out some of the hunt area that we had heard a lot of people end up killing bison on, and we did find a lot of tracks, and eventually just had to retreat back to Roan, back to that guide camp, and stay there for that night. Then we'd pack up our camp and take it with us the next day and try to set it up somewhere in the middle of the hunt area.
How did it progress from there, Chris?
Yeah, so we went back and then we packed everything back up because that day we kind of just took sleds with sleeping bags, stuff in case we made it to that cabin, we could stay there, but we didn't take our big tent and stuff. We left that back there. So the next day we packed up the tent, everything, threw it all in the two sleds because we were down one sled. That one was broke. So we hit the trail pretty early, just figuring it was going to take us a lot longer than we anticipated. So we made it in there and then we made it past where we had started seeing sign. And then just kept looking for sign, right? And I mean, that first little stretch is, you're kind of in the foothills above the river a little bit, and it's all benched out really bad. So like they could be hiding anywhere in there, and it was kind of overwhelming. Like there could be anywhere, we just can't see them. But we spent quite a bit of time glassing. Then we made it down to actual the Farewell Lake, which is a big lake, and then there's a whole chain of little lakes everywhere. And then we decided to send Hunter, who didn't have a sled, down to Bear Creek Cabin just to check it out, look for signs, see if the cabin was available as an option still. So he split off from us. He went running down the trail, and me and Mark started hitting these lakes. There's just chains of lakes, and you can kind of hop over to each lake. And we just spent almost half the day going around these lakes, checking out old abandoned cabins. And there was a little airstrip we found, which was actual Farewell Lodge back in the day. It burned down, but yeah, I mean, and then we found a pocket that just had a ton of sign on the lakes and fresh sign and all sorts of tracks. And then there was a trail we knew that went out to the Farewell airstrip, and we were trying to find it, and we could not find the trail, could not find the trail. And then we were kind of skirting the trail along these chains of lakes, trying to find an access point. And then we ended up finally finding a little access point. We hiked up there and we found the trail. So we knew we could get in there, and we knew that was another good spot to go check out and a ton more country. So we kind of made the decision we were going to camp somewhere close to there. And as we were sitting up there, three guys on snowmobiles came out of that trail, and it ended up being one of the other tag holders. So we ended up talking to them for quite a while. And they were camped on one of the lakes down the way a little bit. So we kind of came up with a game plan, and then we were in reaching Hunter, and we said, hey, he told us the cabin is kind of full of people. And he said, we lost sign a couple miles down the trail. He's like, there's not much for any kind of sign. Moose everywhere, that's about it. So we kind of decided we're going to camp right around that area by the lakes. And we had seen open water, a little creek off the trail. So we backtracked about 2.5 miles to this open water. And then me and Mark started setting up camp, and we just struggled finding a spot that wasn't just frozen solid ice to get stakes in for the tent. And we ended up kind of camping pretty deep in the trees, which wasn't ideal, but it worked. It was a spot we could get stakes in because everything's frozen solid. So we set up camp, and then Hunter showed up. And yeah, then we spent the night there, and the next morning we just figured we'd go without sleds. We could just throw our backpacks on the back of the snowmobiles and go light and just cover country. So, and this was day five, so it was March 4 at this point. And I mean, just looking at the logistics and how long everything was taking us, I was kind of starting to get a little nervous. Mark could probably attend to that, but I mean, I was like, we haven't even seen a bison yet. What are we doing? So I was getting a little bit nervous at that point.
Yeah, there's so much time and effort and money for that matter, like invested at this point. And I don't mean just leading up to the hunt, of course, that, but like when you're in those moments and you're spending those days and you're putting in such hard work and covering all this ground and dealing with the setbacks, it's like just seeing something is relieving at that point to know, like, okay, we're not just out here struggling. We're actually hunting, you know? But up until the point you start seeing game, you don't necessarily feel like you're hunting.
Yeah, and we had covered so much country and just hadn't even laid our eyes on one yet. And it was a little different than what I thought going in. I thought we were gonna it, like I thought it was gonna be a super easy hunt. You'd just see them and like, but it turned out to be quite the difference. And yeah, like you said, we were just sore from riding and tired. And I mean, it was a bit different than I anticipated because I grew up snowmobiling, but it was mountain sleds, so we were just. It's completely different, these big trail sleds. And I mean, these things are just workhorses, but the trail just beats the death out of you.
Did that end up happening the next day? You guys throw on go light, go with the snowmobiles and just kind of packs.
Yeah, so we ended up just packing up pretty early, and We made it to that trail, split off the lake, and then, well, we actually stopped at those guys' camp because they told us where they're camping. We got their information, so we were kind of in reaching. But we just stopped in there, and then we talked to them, and they had told us where they had been spending their time in that area, because it's a huge area and there's split offs everywhere. And I was just kind of like, well, where are you guys going? I don't want to kind of screw you guys up. And they said, we're going to go back to where we were, off to the left side. We're going to spend our day in there. So we were like, okay, well, I want to get back way to the back. There's a big mountain type hill back there that I knew if we got there, we'd have vantage point. And I'd heard it was just a good place to check out. So we were like, we're going to go way to the back and we're going to check it out back there. And they had seen bison the day before. So I kind of had more hope going in there. So yeah, we hit the trail and we ended up going past where they had turned off. And I think it was like, oh, 17 miles from camp to this place we wanted to make it. And yeah, we made it to the farewell airstrip. But yeah, going through there, it was just completely different terrain, a lot more flat, almost like swampy moose country it looked like. And we seen a ton of moose, and there was tons and tons of wolf sign, so much wolf sign everywhere. But we knew we were kind of in the general right direction then. And then we had almost made it to this hill I wanted to make it to. And Hunter started yelling at us. And he's like, guys, 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 it's bison. And we had given him so much crap the day before leading up to it because he wouldn't wear his binoculars. And of course, he's the one that spots him first. So we kind of just made a game plan. Like, we still got to get up to the top of this hill just because we wanted to just be able to get a lay of the land, because you can't really see from the trail very far. But I mean, you could still see quite a ways. But we just wanted to make it to the top of the hill. We tried, and it was actually pretty windblown and side hilling, and like the sleds just couldn't make it up there. So we backtracked, went down to the base of it, and we just kind of got a game plan together. We're like, let's just throw our packs on and head out to the edge of these trees and just take a look at these bison that we've seen, right? Like, we just wanted to get eyes on them. So we did that. We packed up and just ended up hoofing it out there. And everyone we talked to had told us, don't leave your sleds, don't leave your sleds. But we did it. We threw our packs on and we ended up hiking to the edge of the trees, and they were still about 1,200 to 1,000 yards out, and they were bedded at that point. They had bedded down. So
To describe a little bit where they were, where like there's mountains in the backdrop and this big hill beside us, but where the bison were bedded was like just a wide open flat, just flat tundra out in the middle, away from the trees, like Chris said, 1,000 yards out from any cover. So that's kind of what we were trying to decide how we could close the gap and go look, get a look at them. And without being like having any elevation, setting up the spotter was pretty much futile. All you could see was, the top third or quarter of their bodies, the tops of their heads and tops of their backs. So without them standing up, we needed to figure out how to close the gap.
what type of I'm assuming rifle, Chris, are you using cartridge wise? And then, like, what were you hoping to get into range wise? As you talk about, they're in the open, you gotta close the distance. What were you hoping for?
So I have a 300 Win Mag, and I mean, I'm comfortable shooting long range, but at the same point, the wind was just howling that day, a side wind.
Yeah.
So I knew we wanted to get pretty close. So I didn't know exactly how close we wanted to get, but that's kind of why we wanted to get to the top of the hill, is just to get a vantage point, get a lay of the land, figure out what we could do, if it was worth going after them. But that kind of fell through. So then, yeah, like Mark said, it was like once we got to the edge of the trees, it almost looked like big wheat fields in Montana, kind of in the foothills, but it was just flat where we were. And you could barely see them through the grass, just the top of them. So then we kind of looked at the maps and We kind of figured we didn't have another option. There was just a couple sparse little trees and snowdrifts here and there. So we kind of just started picking our way in a single file line behind these trees. And we didn't know anything about how spooky they were, like how good their eyesight was, anything like that. And we knew that we had the wind working with us. So we knew the wind wasn't going to be an issue. So we kind of just started working our way in there, and we got to, I don't know, probably 700, 600 yards. And we just kept like discussing it with each other, like, well, what do we do, right? Like, we're kind of running out of cover. But then we figured it was our first herd we've seen. We're finally in them. And everyone I had talked to said they're kind of spread out, and like the bulls will kind of hang out on their own. So I was kind of like not expecting there to be a big bull in there. But at the same point, like we just wanted to go look, go put eyes on them, get the spotter on them, and just watch them for a while. But still, even at like 600, 700 yards, you couldn't get a good vantage of them with the spotter. So we were like, we just got to keep moving forward. So there ended up being just one or two more little trees. So then I think we made it to 400 yards, and we actually got set up, got the spotter out. I actually got my rifle on a tripod, up in the air a little bit, sitting down, and got set up, and you could kind of see them, but still they're bedded in the grass. And there was one in there that just body size looked so much bigger than the rest of them, and we had no idea kind of what we were looking at, but we were like, that's a big bodied animal. But I got set up, and I just didn't feel comfortable at 400 yards even, because the wind was blowing so hard sideways on that tripod. My gun was kind of moving quite a bit. So we kind of, in the end, I was like, we got to get closer, guys. So we ended up sneaking in to like 200 yards. And when I say we're sneaking in, we're like just crawling almost in a single file line. And these things looked like they were 50 yards away from us the whole time, because they're so big. And we're like, we're way too close. We're way too close. But we got to 200, and we didn't know if they just didn't care, didn't see us, or what. But we got to 200, and we got set up. I should say we left our packs and everything back at 400 yards. We just kind of carried the spotter and my rifle up to 200. And we got set up there, and it was the same thing, right? They're all just still bedded. One or two of them would start getting up and milling around. But then at 200 yards, we just had a really good idea of what was going on. And still, that one just looked so much bigger than the rest of them. But you couldn't get a good view of him laying down. So we got set up, and I bet we sat there for almost 45 minutes, and it started getting terribly cold. Mark can attest to that, but we were getting cold. And we left everything back at 400 yards. So we kind of just were like, we got to do something. We can't sit here forever. I mean, we're starting to freeze to death. So we were like, Mark, you just got to get up and start doing jumping jacks or something, jokingly. And so, because we were cold, we didn't know what they were going to do. We didn't know if they were going to spook. We didn't know what was going to happen.
Real quick, my mentality, or I kind of feel like our what we discussed too as we were stalking in, was that this is the first group we've seen, and we have time, like we should just keep getting closer, because we can't do anything from where we are, and it's still somewhat early in the hunt, and this is the first group we've seen. We're just getting into good country. So even if we happen to blow them out, I didn't, at that point, still, I didn't feel like it was a big deal. So we erred on the side of just be aggressive. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, because we kind of just, every time we'd stop, we'd kind of just discuss with each other, like, well, we still, and yeah, it was day four of the season at this point. And I had told them, I was like, I want to be choosy, right? I don't want to just shoot the first thing we see. So in the back of my mind, I'm like, okay, we're in bison now. Let's just go get a look at them. Like Mark said, if they do blow out, oh well, right? So yeah, we snuck in there, and we still didn't know if this was anything we were interested in or not. So We were like, we got to at least get him to stand up, otherwise we're going to freeze to death. So Mark stood up, and the minute he stood up and stretched, like they all turned their attention to us. Clearly, they had no idea we were there, and they started popping up left and right. And this big bull finally turned his head right towards us, and you could see just him laying down still. He turned his head, and in the video, Hunter's just like, no doubt about it. And I could just tell the excitement level from those guys all of a sudden shot up like tenfold. They're like, oh, wow, because that's a big bull. And there was no doubt once he turned his head towards us, we didn't need any other information. So then I was just set up ready. I'm like, okay. Mark's like, do you like him? I'm like, he's a big boy. And so then once he stood up, we were all kind of like, oh, it's game on. Like my thought of holding out went out the window instantly. I'm like, I'm shooting this thing. And he stood up for probably 10 seconds, but he was quartering to me really hard. And I really didn't want to put a round through that big shoulder. So I was kind of still waiting for him to turn for a good, nice, perfect shot. And yeah, I'd say 10 seconds, they stood there and all of a sudden they were gone. A split second later, they were stampeding away.
And so, yeah, at that point, I think Hunter and I were waiting for the shot when he was quartering too, because he was clear and we knew, like we had discussed, and people told us, the only thing you don't want to happen is that they bunch up, like bison can bunch up like musk ox, where it's just a big cluster and then you're pretty much done for. So we were waiting for the shot, and when they started running, Hunter and I were pretty well dejected, like, well, that's it. It's over. And there might have been a few other choice words thrown out. And they're like, oh man, it's over. This thing's blown. All of a sudden, boom. And Hunter and I are like scrambling. What just happened? He just shot. What's going on? And so I'm scrambling back to get my binoculars and start ranging, because the direction they ran was, it wasn't straight away, it was like lightly quartered away. I would say maybe like a 15 or 20 degree angle. So they were still kind of like, they're just running more or less to the side. And I was like, all right, I got to relocate where that bull is and range them and everything. And then so as I was watching, I was like, he's in the middle, he's in the middle. But then he moved like middle, but our side of the herd, so we could see him wide open. And then Chris took it from there, I guess.
Yeah, so I could just, the minute they started stampeding, I was just so dialed into that bull at that point. Like I was just looking for a shot, and they're stampeding away, and I could just hear Mark and Hunter behind me, like their spirits just got crushed. And even in the video, Hunter had shut the video off because he thought it was over, right? He thought it was done. So we don't even have the first shot on video. And it was, they were running away, like he said, kind of quartering away a little bit, but I just tracked this bull and he was so easy to see in this herd because he was so much bigger than anything else around him. And the minute he got clear of everyone, they're kind of running away. I just snuck one in there and it was kind of a quartering away shot. So it hit far back, but kind of quartered in towards the front. And it wasn't the best shot, but it was enough to slow him down. And he definitely slowed way down, got behind the rest of the pack. And then, like Mark said, he got clear and he turned broadside. And I snuck another one right in behind the front shoulder. And I saw lung air instantly. So I knew it was a good hit. And Mark's like, it's a good hit, good hit. But then he just stood there. And at that point, the rest of the herd had stopped probably 50 yards away and kind of turned back to watch him for a split second. And then I snuck another one in right behind the shoulder again. And that one actually hit his offside shoulder. So then he kind of dropped in the front. And you could just tell it was done from there. But then the other herd took off again, like just a big snowstorm of snow blowing because the wind's blowing. And Mark and Hunter just kind of scrambling behind me, like, what just happened? And then, yeah, we watched him and he went down and we were just like, holy smokes.
Yeah, so where that hap that ended up, those last shots were right at 300 yards. So they had just covered 100 yards. And yeah, Chris did his job behind the rifle.
Bang. It's it's just a massive animal. I say that just based off of a photo. I'm sure walking up to that thing just had to have been pretty amazing and probably a bit overwhelming. It makes me think of, I grew up as a Midwest whitetail hunter, and the first time I walked up on an elk on the ground, which, elk don't even compare to a bison at this point, but going from like whitetail to elk, it was like the first time I actually had one on the ground. I was like, holy cow, and I'm sure it was a pretty similar thing walking up on a bison.
So then we had left the sleds back and we had almost covered, it was like 3/4 of a mile, I bet. So we decided, let's go back, get our pack packs, and then go back to the sleds because we figured we could just ride our sleds all the way out to this bison. It's in the middle of this grass field. So we went back to the sleds, packed everything back up, and we kind of snuck through the trees. And we popped out into this big wide open field and we drove right up to the thing. And yeah, once I hopped off, walking up to it, it was just surreal how big this thing was. And I was just in shock still at the point. Like we hadn't seen a bison until 2 hours ago. So like
Yeah.
I had no idea what to expect. And it was just, it all happened so fast. It finally hit me. And I'm like, holy cow, it finally happened. And then just grabbing the head of that thing, I couldn't even pick his head up by myself. It was unbelievable. And I should say there was already ravens on it, and they had picked one of his eyeballs out already.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about, aging, scoring, size, etc. And I don't know if you have any information like of the above, not that it matters, but I'm curious, like any information, data on the bison you harvested. Like, was it,
Well,
I
so
mean, you said it was big
yeah,
compared to some of the others, but do you have any context around that?
we didn't know either anything about that. So then, but we just saw it in there and we just knew it was a decent sized bull and so much bigger than anything else. And it got me excited right away. So I was like, yeah, that's the one I want to take.
That's all that really matters.
But then still, like, we had no idea on the ground. Once we got up to it, we were like, we don't know if this is a big bison. We don't know anything about this. And looking back, we should have taken measurements. We never measured anything, but so we don't have any kind of measurements. We don't have anything, but yeah, we should have probably measured something. But the skull's in Anchorage still. So once I get it back, we'll do some measuring.
Yeah, I didn't know. We didn't know how to age them either. trying to do it like mountain goats or sheep, was like when I looked at it through that frame point, I was like, yeah, sure, it was bigger than anything else there, but I'm not sure that it's old, because it doesn't have the same type of annuli, I guess. So I was like, I mean, I don't know. This might be a relatively young bull, just bigger than everything else, like a 3, 4 year old, like how a mountain goat will, a 3 and 4 year old billy might still be hanging out with nannies and kids. It kind of seemed like maybe that was the situation with this one. I was like, I don't know. Maybe it's just a 3, 4 year old bull. But I guess after the point, sharing pictures and the pilot he's guided a bunch of hunts out there and has a lot of experience with them. He said it was really comparable to, what do you say, Chris? Like a 7 or 8 year old seemed really similar to one that he harvested years back that was seven.
Yeah, he just said very big bodied.
I mean, you can't, like you said, Chris, you can't even pick up the head on this thing. I'm assuming in terms of working on it, you're just kind of doing the traditional gutless, like work on a side, try and move this thing when you can. Like, I mean, good thing you have three guys. I'm sure just even wrestling a quarter off just takes a bunch of strength and hands.
Yeah, so then we got up to it and it was like it was on its side, completely on its side. And we had this amazing mountain backdrop right behind us. And I was like, we got to get this thing on its haunches for pictures. And they kind of looked at me like, what? So yeah, we wrestled that thing, the three of us, and getting its legs underneath it was just a feat of nature. But we did it somehow. Mark got under there and pulled the leg from underneath as me and Hunter were shoving. And we got it kind of upright for pictures, which actually helped quite a bit because then, yeah, we just tipped it back a little bit. And then, honestly, it wasn't terrible to work on what we had three very experienced guys doing it. But the hide was the craziest part, how thick it was around the head and the butt. Like it was like probably an inch thick around the horns and the head and then around the butt. Just crazy thick hide.
It's wild just looking at pictures like you sitting by this thing. You just, I mean, it makes me think of like, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. You just look like a
Yeah.
tiny toddler.
Yeah. So we ended up, we all three of us started on it and we got the first two quarters off because I was just doing I wanted to do a Euro and a rug. So we kind of just caped it out like a rug. And so we started at the bottom and then worked up and we got the back strap out. And Mark's kind of like, well, maybe we should start shuttling meat because we had that giant airstrip 2 miles away. So I was in contact with the pilot and he was just like, yeah, make sure there's like 6 to 8 inches of snow or less. So Mark ended up loading a snowmobile, just the back of a snowmobile. We had no sleds at this point. And he made his first trip and he came back and he's like, yeah, there's probably 1 inch, maybe 2 inches of snow on this runway. And it's a 3,000 foot runway. It's a huge runway. And this pilot has a big plane and a little plane. So he said if we could get the big plane in there, it'd be a lot more cost effective. So it actually worked out amazingly well. Mark shuttled four loads to the strip, and me and Hunter just cut this bison up. And I think we were into it 3.5 hours by the time we were done. And then we all loaded up the last load, and I had the hide on the back of my snowmobile. And I bet the hide was 125 pounds all rolled up. So we went back to the airstrip and Mark had found like a little, 'cause it's gotta be a moose hunting area and people just leave their four wheelers and stuff on this airstrip. So we had found a little trailer and a bunch of old wooden pallets. So we stacked all the meat on pallets by this trailer and then tarped it all really good because we knew there was wolves everywhere in there. And we kind of have a little bit of experience with wolves and meat and we know they don't like tarps and stuff like that, just from that very first hunt we ever did. So we figured if we tarped it, we'd probably be good. And we knew it was going to freeze solid because it was so cold. So, yeah, I mean, in the aspects of where we killed it in location to the airstrip, I mean, it couldn't have worked out any better because we had 4 hours into shuttling meat and then we were basically done with it, which was kind of weird from like doing normal hunts. Like, then you didn't have to deal with anything. We had the meat there, the head there, the hide there. We were done. Like we didn't know what to do after that point.
Yeah, not having to put something on our back was kind of a new experience.
Yeah, I mean, when you think of the size of the animal and the task, that's seems like about as efficient as it could possibly be, you know, between breaking it down, having one guy shuttle, having the machines like right next to it. I mean, seems like ideal for sure.
Yeah, it worked out awesome. I mean, the very last couple loads he did was in the dark. So it was getting dark, but I mean, it wasn't super late by any means. And I don't know, Mark, what would you think? We probably had 600 to 650 pounds of meat and head and hide by the time we were done. So, I mean, doing that on your back would have been just a giant task.
Yeah, for sure. I think that definitely the way to do it. I think that fall hunt could be a lot tougher. Not having that snow machine capability, or if you can't get a machine to something.
So the plan is pilot comes in, takes care of the bison, all the meat, everything at the runway, but you guys are still gonna sled out.
Yeah, so then we had figured so I contacted the pilot. I said, "Hey, meat is at the airstrip, everything's ready." And he said he was doing a little bit of maintenance. He's like, "Give him a couple days." So we just headed back to camp that night, and once we actually got to the lakes, and we saw lights going across the lake, and we thought it was the other hunters, our buddies that were camped on the lake at first, but then it was moving. And then we were like, "Holy smokes, that's probably one of the Iditarod guys." Well, it ended up being the very lead guy was crossing that lake at like 10:30 that night. So it was pretty cool to see all of a sudden the sled dogs are going by. So we stopped by those other guys' camp, showed them pictures and everything, and talked to them for a while. And then we were like, "Well, we got to bomb back to camp because we want to get off the trail before it gets too crazy." We didn't know anything about these sled dogs, like if how fast they come through, how bunched up they are. And we had about 2 miles back to our camp still. So we ran back to camp, and then we ended up just kind of watching the trail. And we saw probably three or four more sled dogs come by that night. It was just so cool to see. And it's just all you hear is the dogs' collars jingling, and you can barely hear the runners of the sleds. It was just kind of, I don't know, it was just peaceful and just cool to see.
Super unique experience, man. That's very cool.
Yeah, so then we spent the night, and then our plan the next day was just kind of build a fire, drink coffee, and watch the race because they just came by steadily the whole next day. And we knew we were kind of waiting on the pilot still. And he had told us, he's like, "If you got any extra gear, just dump it at the runway." Well, then we figured we were going to drop the tent, our cots, and just a bunch of the big bulky stuff because we knew we had to limp a sled out still. We had that one broken sled still back at Roan. So we were kind of just waiting on the pilot. And I mean, pilots in Alaska, they're just kind of on their own schedule and you got to work around them. So we were kind of hoping we'd go check for wolves. That was kind of in the back of our minds the whole time, but we didn't want to go too far from camp. At the same time, we kind of wanted to go look for wolves, especially check like the gut pile and stuff like that. But that next day, we ended up just staying at camp, watching races go by. And I mean, it was such a cool experience. And then we spent one more night there, spent the next day watching the tail end of the race. And then I had a buddy at home that was just keeping us updated when the teams were leaving Roan. So we knew, he's like, "Hey, the last team has left Roan." And he told us kind of the grouping they were in. So we watched them go by, and then we knew the trail was clear. So we're like, "Okay, we're gonna go hit the trail. We're gonna go look for wolves." And then all of a sudden, the pilot sends me a message. He's like, "Hey, I'm coming in the morning." And we're like, "Okay, do you need help loading it?" And he's like, "Nope, I got it." So we came up with a game plan. We're like, "Okay, we're going to load up our tent, everything tonight, run it out to the airstrip quick." So we packed up camp quick. I bombed a load out to the airstrip, which was probably 21, 22 miles back on a sled. I dumped it off. They finished packing up camp. I got back to the camp. We hooked up the two sleds and we just bombed back to Roan. And we got to Roan pretty late that night. It was probably 11 o'clock almost. So then we just camped there for the night. And then we just figured we'd hit the trail hard tomorrow and make it. Our goal was to make it back to Squintna. But if everything went well, we figured we'd get all the way out. But I mean, just everything never goes as planned. And yeah, the next day we kind of fixed that sled back up and loaded everything up. And we made it probably halfway up the pass, and we ran into the Iditarod Czech crew again, who had rode over with. So we kind of piggybacked with them for a while, and then our sled broke again. Me and Hunter actually stopped, and we couldn't find Mark. And we waited for probably 5, 6, 7 minutes, and we're like, "Where is he?" And finally, Hunter looks down and he picks up this trailer hitch, and he's like, "Oh, I bet I know where Mark is." His trailer was just gone, and Mark was back in the woods with his trailer. We ended up limping all the way, and we got to Squintna actually pretty late. It was probably 8 o'clock, and she was happy to see us. She cooked us pizzas, and we spent the night there again and kind of just took it all in. And then, yeah, we hit the trail the next day and we fought that trailer again the next day. So finally, I got sick of it and we picked it up and just strapped it to the top of all my gear on my trailer. And we're like, we just got to get out of here. And then at that point, we had noticed Mark's sled was leaking oil really bad. He had a sensor that had blown through. So he was spewing oil out. So we were just adding oil to get out. And yeah, that next day was kind of challenging because we just knew we were so close to get out, but yet so far, and like everything just seemed to be falling apart. So we just limped our way out and we made it.
So close yet so far makes me think of our sheep hunt, Mark.
Definitely not the first time having feelings like that. And Mark
Oh,
kept telling
man.
us, we're not out yet. We're not out yet.
Oh, cool. Man, it's so like when you have a hunt like this, the hunt itself is unique and you have success and everything else. But then when you pair it with like just extra special stuff, right? Like getting to watch those sled dogs come through and just experiencing the people and kind of the culture, that little roadhouse and all that stuff just makes a hunt like that even cooler and more memorable.
Yeah, Mark asked me after the when we got back, he's like, "Well, how does this hunt rate on all your hunts?" And I was like, "Honestly, it's probably at the top of the list. I mean, we've done some gnarly stuff together. My goat hunt was quite an adventure, and but I just think the whole aspect of everything we did, the adventure, like you said, the sled dogs and watching the ITI people and just the monumental effect of everything that went into it. The hunt itself was awesome, but everything else made it just over the top. Like it was just an experience we'll probably never do again, and not a lot of people get to do.
Man, we could cut it there, and obviously we've already spent a ton of time, but is there anything else, whether it's takeaways, lessons learned, or just something, I mean, it could be something, it's a funny, silly story. I mean, we could wrap it there, or is there, I just don't want to leave anything out that you guys want to mention.
We could spend hours talking about lessons learned and
Yeah, I'm
what to
sure.
do differently, but I mean, it's just a huge learning experience. And yeah, we learned a lot for sure. And we would probably do a little bit different, but I think we did really, really well.
So is this your next outfitting guiding adventure, Mark? Are you going to specialize in bison hunts now?
I don't think so, man. That would be an expensive a hunt. I think it's
Yeah,
pretty.
when we looked at the prices of guide the outfitters, and we were kind of like, holy smokes, that's ridiculous for that, you know? But I mean, in the end, they are not far off. I mean, unless you had gear all the way in there all the time and like you knew exactly what to do, I mean, it's just such a hard, monumental task to get in there. It's expensive.
Yeah, I mean, it was overwhelming enough to do it like with good friends and high quality, well experienced hunters. I'm not sure that it's a formulation for a business for me, anyway.
Did you, I know you said earlier, didn't throw much on a scale and things like that, but I'm curious, did you ever get the head and horns on a scale? And just, I would be curious what just that weighs.
We didn't. So we ended up picking up. We had to quick bomb down and pick up the meat and head from this guy's hangar. And then we ended up rushing down to Anchorage and we barely made it to the expediter in time. We just dumped the head and hide off at the expediter because then we figured that was our best option because we were an hour and a half away and then heading all the way back to Mark's house. We were heading the other direction. So we really just flew out, grabbed it, dropped it off at the nick of time on a Friday night. And so it was kind of overwhelming just getting rid of it all so fast, but we didn't have time to do anything like that.
When you do get it back eventually, I'd love to hear about it.
Would you, Chris, did you? I feel like I didn't feel like the head was super heavy, especially, I mean, you cleaned it pretty clean once you pull the lower jaw and tongue off. But I didn't feel like that was particularly heavy. Like those horns are not as dense as like sheep horns, I wouldn't say.
No, I would just say like the size of the actual bone structure of the head is probably most of the weight. The horns aren't overly aggressively heavy. Like you said, like sheep horns are just so heavy. But it's definitely heavier than a sheep head, I'd say, but not by much. I
But
don't
not for
know.
the size of it.
Yeah, I mean it was
Gotcha.
heavy, but not as heavy as I think you'd think it would be.
Okay. Yeah, that's why I'm like looking at a picture. I'm thinking, man, if that's remotely similar in density to sheep, that has to be very, very heavy. But yeah, it sounds like it's thinner and not as dense.
Well, yeah, sheep horns have just so much mass to them, too.
Yeah. Cool. Well, guys, thanks for sharing the story. What a unique adventure. And again, I just personally wanted to hear about it. So, personally, thank you. But thanks for being willing to do the podcast and share the story with listeners. It's super cool.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's not much information out there on it either. Like, we tried researching, and it's so hard to find information on the hunt. So, I mean, if anything helps anybody, I mean, it's cool.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, just super awesome experience. Great to get to do it and great to relive it by telling the story and looking through pictures and stuff. So, feel super grateful to do something like that. Hopefully, one day I'll draw or somebody else I know gets to draw and get to go again, but it's pretty unlikely.
Well, that was a pretty wild adventure. Thanks again to Mark and Chris for sharing the story with us. Thank you to you, the listeners, for tuning in and also supporting the show. Again, if you're able to leave a rating or review for the podcast, that would help us tremendously. And if there's anything we can do to help you out, or if you have any sort of question for a future episode, a topic suggestion, a guest suggestion, anything like that, please shoot us an email. It's a podcast@exomountaingear.com. We'd love to hear from you. And finally, if you haven't yet, be sure to hit subscribe or follow in your podcast app so that you receive all future episodes automatically. And as always, for free. And we'll talk to you soon.